It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. I'm really excited about our next segment. We've been talking about Wrigleyville and Clark Street as we continue to celebrate Cubs culture, talk about World Series. It's World Series week here in the download. And, you know, we thought about it because there's been so many stories in the news about cover charges and, you know, how much money it's going to take to watch a baseball game in Wrigleyville. And it got us thinking about just Wrigleyville and how that area is really sort of, it's changed over the years. It hasn't always been sort of a corporate sports bar area. As a matter of fact, we've had guests on the program. We've talked about it from bands like Naked Ray Gun, Urge Overkill, talking about Joe Shanahan from Metro, talking about a different Wrigleyville than even what it was 10, 15 years ago. So I thought we'd bring in some people to talk about this. Bill Savage, good to see you.
Good to be back.
Good to see you. He teaches literature at Northwestern at the Newberry Library as well, and he has written the intro and the notes for George Ade's The Old Time Saloon. It's a new book, which is out now.
Just out from U of Chicago Press. Get one.
There it is. And Liz Garvey. Liz is a beer and bar historian who's working on the new Chicago Brewseum, which I think is a great idea and should be done by now. I'm surprised it hasn't been done. Liz, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't we start with you, Liz? I mean, it's very interesting that, you know, Wrigleyville is not always been called that. I mean, it really is Lakeview, and people in Chicago know that. And Lakeview wasn't necessarily a neighborhood. It was really started as almost like a suburban development.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about Chicago history and what Chicago originally was, our boundaries in a sense, I think people hopefully know that we were established in 1837. 1871 people I think are familiar with as well, right? The Great Chicago Fire. And at that point, just to give you some context, our northern boundary was North Avenue, Fullerton during the fire. So we're talking about the Lakeview area, which is basically like a northern suburb. You know, 1850s, 1870s. And so it was really established. Of course, Native Americans were there and had some settlements. And really we had some German immigrants settling there, farmers. You know, one fun fact I always love to tell people is that Lakeview Township at one point was the celery growing capital of the country. So people were growing celery like crazy. People ask a hot dog, right?
I think that's why we put celery salt on our hot dogs. Right, I can't prove that, though.
Wow, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
You just say it, like, authoritatively.
People with authority.
Yeah, a little confidence.
But if you look at around Chicago, all of what we think of as sort of dense urban neighborhoods, everything outside those original city boundaries were once developments sold to people as get away from the dirty city, come out to Lakeview, Edgewater, Hyde Park. You know, these are names that nowadays would sound like a suburban subdivision because they originally were incorporated into the city in the 1890s, right before the fair.
So let me ask you, I mean, there's so much made about the last time the Cubs won the World Series, 1908. What was the saloon scene? What was the bar scene like in 1908 here in Chicago? Was it as bustling? I mean, people waiting in lines and the cover charges?
The cover charge was a whopping 50 cents.
No, and a beer was a nickel.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly bustling, right? But that's also, you got to put that in context of history.
One of the things to remember is that nowadays we have a post-prohibition saloon culture or bar and tavern culture, a lot of prohibitionist dry attitudes. Back in the day in Chicago, the main source of income for the city was liquor licenses. There weren't any property taxes. So everyone complaining about property taxes nowadays harken back to the days of no property taxes, but saloons everywhere. And these saloons were of two basic types, and this is Perry Dewis's great research, right? You had your American bars, which were run by German and Irish, more assimilated immigrants, and you had your ethnic bars, where people would speak Polish or Czech or Bohemian in neighborhoods that were dominated by those ethnic groups. So in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, you had way more bars than we have now, but they served really important social purposes.
I mean, they were really centers of information, right? If you were looking for a job for your cousin who would be coming from Poland, you'd go to the bar where people knew you, you'd share information, you'd get the latest gossip, in a sense, you start networking. I actually like to call the 19th century saloon the original Facebook, right? This is where you got all of the comings and goings and kind of reached out for help in some capacity. So the saloon, you know, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, I mean, this was the place, not just to go drink, but to really just kind of exchange camaraderie, exchange information.
Let me ask you, I mean, and we're going to talk about this, about the idea of the quote-unquote sports bar. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, was at the time in 1908 when the Cubs were winning World Series at that time, I mean, were the bars sports-oriented? I mean, did you get the scores and were there sort of chatter and things around the idea of a Cubs game?
Absolutely. The thing to remember is back in these days, you had daily newspapers that would put out multiple editions a day. So I call that the 19th century internet. People would pick up the paper and bring it into the bar and share the box scores. Ben Hecht, the great Chicago journalist, his very first job on the Daily News was compiling the box score of that day's Cubs and Sox games, which would be on the front page of the paper. So it's 3 o'clock, the factory lets out, the ball game started at 11 a.m. or noon or 1 o'clock, and you go to the tavern on your way home, and there's the newspaper with that day's box score.
Tell you who won, right.
Obviously, we're talking before TV, much less radio, much less internet. But sports were one of the things men talked about in bars, and these are primarily male preserves. The sporting life was sort of a code term for gambling and some other vice activities. But any bar would have in it people who knew about sports. Maybe the guy you're betting on the World Series with is in there, and he knows you, you know him. You put down a couple of 50-cent bets on the next game. It was absolutely a center, but all saloons were like that. Right. There wasn't a genre of sports bar.
Let's take a quick break, and we come back. Let's get into the genre of sports bar. When that actually happened, the idea of the TVs coming into store, and really, you know, a culture around sports. And then talk about Wrigleyville and the concept of what is considered a Chicago sports bar as opposed to a corporatized version of such. Sure. Bill Savage, Liz Gerbe in studio with me tonight. We're talking the history of saloons, taverns, and Wrigleyville as we know it. We're celebrating Cubs culture, World Series week here on The Download. Stay with us. It's Download here on 720 WGN. It is World Series week. Talking about Cubs culture, we're talking about saloon culture and the original sports bars here in Chicago, and then we're going to get into a little Wrigleyville talk. Bill Savage teaches literature at Northwestern and the Newberry Library. He has written the intro, and he also has done the notes for George Ade's The Old Time Saloon, which is out now on the University of Chicago Press. Liz Gerbe is a bar and beer historian who's working on a new Chicago Brewseum, which needs to happen. So in studio. All right, so let's talk about the genre of sports bar, because we talked about the saloon, and sports was obviously a big part of it. Where does the sports bar come from?
I think the sports bar probably develops in the late 70s, early 80s, when cable TV takes over the world and ESPN starts to eat everything. So like, as I said earlier, people are always talking about sports in bars because people are talking about everything in bars, politics, jobs, local stuff. Like, the bar is kind of a liquid newspaper. Everything you would find in a newspaper, you would find in a bar. Sports bars grow up as an economic idea that if I put up more TVs than the guy next door, and I worked as a bartender for over 30 years, and I remember when a place I worked at up in Edgewater, Hamilton's, which late lamented Hamilton's, got a satellite. But, you know, this giant dish that nowadays you'd think would be like on the Starship Enterprise. And they could get in like games that other people couldn't see, and suddenly you made a lot of money. So now there's some bars I like, down on 95th Street, Tavern in the Green in Evergreen Park. They have more TVs than I have books, and I'm an English professor. I mean, I have lots of books. And that kind of idea that here's a bar you go to in order to watch sports, talk sports, consume sports as an object has its parallels, right? There's single bars. There's gay bars, right? There's bars people go to for specific social reasons. Sports is a thing that can transcend that. There's gay sports bars. I mean, multi-genre bars exist. But it's an interesting thing because it can also be something that kind of drives some people away, right? It can feel fake or ungenuine.
Yeah, and I mean, historically speaking, that has always existed, right? No matter if you're looking at 2016 or 1908 or, you know, 1850, there's always sort of been the place for you. Right. You always find your niche.
Right.
So 19th century, it would have been, I'm going to go to that Italian bar because they speak Italian and that's where I'm from. And I know I can find those newspapers there and communicate effectively and be able to share that cultural knowledge. So sports bars are no different, right? They're just a more of a recent phenomenon. And of course, everyone has their particular sport that they're into or their team. You know, all over the world.
Is there a difference between, say, a sort of a franchise or the idea of a sports bar that you can find in every different town and a Chicago sports bar?
I think there's, you know, anytime you talk about urban life, things apply across the board. In cities, there are certain kinds of bars. I think it differs in different kinds of cities. So in LA or Phoenix or Houston, a car city is going to be different than Chicago, a public transportation kind of city.
More like in the malls, things like that.
But I think the bigger and more important difference is bars that are oriented towards sports organically because they happen to be, say, across the street from a baseball park, like Ray's Bleachers, now Murphy's Bleachers was, and bars that are kind of imported lock, stock, and barrel from corporate headquarters in Des Moines or wherever. And those corporate sports bars are just like, you know, Applebee's is Applebee's wherever you go.
Right.
Versus places that have history and personality like Cubby Bear, Sluggers, Murphy's, Bernie's, Sports Corner, the old four corner bars around Wrigley, which back in the 80s when I started going both to bars and to Wrigley as an adult, were the only bars. You had Nisei, you had Ginger Man, and it was like six bars in Wrigleyville. And it wasn't even Wrigleyville yet. It was East Lakeview.
Yeah.
Right?
That's interesting, yeah. So it wasn't like the bar culture that we know it to be now.
The overwhelming bro bar, strip on Clark Street, bars that are only open when the Cubs are in town. Places like that did not exist yet because, you know, the Cubs averaged sometimes in the 60s and 70s under 10,000 fans a game. There wasn't the energy that's been down there since 84 where you now have, you know, 2 million people, 3 million people a year. So the bars grow up because the customers are there.
Yeah, Clark Street as we know it, I mean, that is definitely a 2000s sort of phenomenon, really. You know, my first sort of lesson in understanding the highs of joy and the lows of complete, utter disappointment and heartbreak came from, you know, I was 10 years old in the 84 Cubs, and in doing a lot of research around a lot of these Wrigleyville bars today and talking to owners and regulars and people that work there and people that are just, you know, been in the area in the neighborhood for so long, it really is interesting to hear their perspective and knowing that, you know, in the 60s 70s, you know, leading up to that 84 season, Lakeview, Wrigleyville was kind of a dump.
You could buy one of those two flats across from Wrigley for $10,000 in the 70s and nobody wanted to.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, give credit to Murphy's. You know, they're the first ones to say, we can put bleachers on our roof. But if you look at historical pictures, every ballpark used to be in a city neighborhood like this. And there were lawsuits between, like, the Philadelphia A's and the people across the street who were putting bleachers on their roof during the 1910 or whatever World Series. And there's pictures from back in the 30s and 40s of people up on the roofs across from Wrigley watching. But the transformation, it's the growth of the fan base and the transformation of nightlife in that neighborhood, which I think the music culture you mentioned earlier was really an important part of. So there was already sort of a critical mass of nightlife culture there that could be expanded by the bar culture. But there's also remnants, and I shouldn't use that word. There are also still institutions.
I was going to ask, what are those institutions? I mean, we see this week we've seen just an overwhelming amount of news on what's going on in Wrigleyville, but we're not talking about the specifics. It's always just about who's got a cover charge.
Well, I'll be honest. If I was a bar owner, the bar owners down there during the regular season, their occupancy card is a joke. They jam those bars full of people. During the postseason, they've got the guy at the door, the clicker, one out, one in. They're paying attention to their occupancy card. If I was a bar owner, I would charge cover and guarantee people seats. And people who want seats will pay that. Because in the regular season, you just jam them in with a shoehorn.
Right.
And as long as the place doesn't burn down, nobody cares. But there are bars that are institutions that have been there forever, like Nisei, 65 years now, a bar founded by Japanese American immigrants who came here after World War II, after the internment camps. They didn't want to go back to California where their neighbors had basically stolen their lives. So they came to Chicago where there was industrial work. And Lakeview was an industrial neighborhood with factories and warehouses that also had bars for guys who worked in factories and warehouses. The ballpark was another workplace.
Right.
And in the old days, the Cubs players were famous for going across the street to Ray's Bleachers.
Ray's is the precursor to
now
Murphy's.
Yeah.
What are some other bars in Wrigleyville that are gone that we don't think about anymore that were a huge part of Wrigleyville that we just don't see?
Well, you know, one of the things I think about when I see what's happening today and just sort of the explosion of people rushing to these bars is you have to give a lot of credit to some of the bar owners that were struggling in the early 80s and really just kind of invested a lot of their money and savings into the seedy neighborhood because they believed in it. So one recent bar that has gone away, I don't know if you remember Justin's on Southport.
Yeah, right.
You know, but Jim Murphy and Justin, I mean, these guys had their bars in the early 80s before that 84 season. and they really kind of just wanted to rally the community together and say, hey, come on, let's improve this area, this neighborhood. I'm going to invest in my business and hopefully get other business owners to come by. And eventually, you know, that season, I think, really saved them in a sense. But really, it was kind of the beginnings of it all.
Do we see – will there be another – I mean, we think about the new bars that are opening up, like you talked about the Bro Bars on Clark Street where they weren't there before. Will we ever see a culture again where a bar like Ray's sticks around for 20, 30 years in a Wrigleyville? Or is this the kind of business now where it's 5 years out, next bar in, that kind of thing?
I think it depends on a couple of, like, bar culture – business details, which include what your capitalization is, who your investors are. Notice that we're naming names here. Justin, Jim Murphy, currently Nisei is owned by like a third generation of owners. Like it's turned over a couple times. But these are guys who decided we're in this for the long haul. We're open even when the Cubs aren't in town.
Right.
We, and partly that's if you're not a huge room with where you got to sell 18,000 chicken wings a night to make your rent, you can afford to do that. So I think the turnover will be among the more corporate places. And
I mean, the rent is a huge part there.
Genuine neighborhood places where people go there even when the Cubs aren't in town because it's their neighborhood bar where their friends are hanging out, where they can still keep up with the news and everything. Those places are always going to endure because those are the neighborhood bars that survive even away from Wrigleyville.
And, you know, it's these places that, like Bill said, they've really created the culture, right? It's not just a business. It's not about, you know, selling food and drink and making sure the TV, the biggest TVs around. It's really about creating community. So, mm-hmm. you know, when Bill and I go and grab a beer at Nisei, we're there with like, you know, maybe six other people in the middle of January, you know, chatting over a beer, but it's comfortable. It's our place. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's kind of just where we feel at home in a sense. So you have bars like Nisei or G-Man Tavern or Higgins over on School and Racine, and they're really kind of just neighborhood joints. They're the corner tap.
That happened to be within walking distance of a Major League ballpark because the Major League ballpark's been there longer than they have.
Right. Well, we have to have this conversation in 5 years. Once the hotel's up and everything changes in Wrigleyville, we'll see if the neighborhood taverns can keep up. Bill Savage teaches literature in Northwestern and at the Newberry Library. He has done the introduction and the notes for George Ade's The Old Time Saloon out on the University of Chicago Press. Liz Garibay is a beer and bar historian. He's working on the new Chicago Brewseum. Love to have you guys back. Thanks for being in tonight. Appreciate it.
Anytime, Justin.
Thanks.